Okay. So I'm glad to be here. Thanks to Bridget and Clint for giving me one of these marathon morning sessions. So I think the first question to address when talking about optimizing image acquisition is what sort of microscope you should be using for what sort of problem. And I would basically prepare a table like this, just to point out that for negative stain EM, you need a very simple microscope, 100, 120 kV. You don't need a field emission gun because you're not going to rely on the coherence of the microscope. You can use a simple side entry room temperature holder, and you can collect your data on a CCD camera without any real loss of performance. Okay, so for screening cryo-EM specimens, if they're larger particles, again, you don't need a field emission gun. For many years, we did our screening of cryo-EM specimens for ATP synthases, things like that, 600 kilodaltons, on 120 kV thermionic emission microscope. That was actually as a graduate student. So only when we saw that we had good grids that we took it to a field emission gun microscope. And this sort of 120 kV microscope will usually be equipped with a side entry cryo holder. And then you have this extra requirement that when you're using a cryo holder, you need a microscope with a somewhat better vacuum than you need for a negative stain microscope and an anti-contaminator. And again, you could collect your data on a CCD camera just to assess whether you've got a good specimen. For screening of smaller particles, that's where the instrumental requirements become more stringent. You need the coherence of a field emission gun, and you need the sensitivity of a direct detector. You don't need the high voltage. So in principle, a 100 kV microscope equipped with a FEG and a DDD would be a great screening tool for assessing the quality of cryo-EM specimens. However, you can't really buy one. Bob's got a comment.
You interrupt John already.
This might be a record.
Maybe. The thing that worries me, comment about it is
the question of how much of a hit does the direct detection camera take if you go down to 100 kV. 200, it's quite okay, but
right.
Yeah.
So it will suffer in performance. I don't have a number for you. I know there are different technologies. It might not be the sort of monolithic active pixel sensor that we use for high voltage direct detection. There are other direct detector devices that perform better at lower voltage. Sure,
yeah,
but I think in principle, there's such a benefit from making a lower voltage microscope that you don't need the separate high tension tank and things like that. That's worth considering for manufacturers, that a simple screening microscope with a redesigned DDD. And I think that's something that Richard is thinking about quite a lot already.
I heard from, I think it's DE, that if you have a DDD on a 120 kV lab 6 microscope, you can actually go 7 nanometer.
Okay.
So then.
Okay, so that's great. So it just shows that my message here, and that's being reinforced, is that people are overestimating their instrumental requirements for the different experiments they're doing. Incidentally, I likely have more slides than I will be able to get through, and almost certainly more slides than I can get through at this pace. I've arranged them in the order that I want to get through them. The notes that will be distributed later will have everything, but we'll see how far we go. Okay. So then we get to the case of where you want to actually get good resolution, where you want to be able to build an atomic model. And a lot of the time, you could do that with a 200 kV microscope. You could do it with a side entry cryo holder. You do need the FEG and the direct detector. When you want your ultimate resolution, that's where we get to the point where, I think my batteries are not quite. That's where we get to the point where we want a high voltage microscope with the direct detector and the FEG. You can still do it with a side entry cryo holder, and that's been demonstrated by Evan Ogalis. Some of our high resolution structures of helical specimens have come from the microscope at Berkeley that has a side entry cryo holder. The only place I'd say where you really need the top of the line microscope is if you want to get the best resolution and you want to do it in a high throughput manner. And that's where you need your high voltage. Higher voltage would be better. Field emission gun, direct detector, and the autoloader. So many of you will know that for many years I was a strong advocate of sticking with an intermediate range microscope. And in Toronto, for many years, actually up until this year, what we had was a 200 kV microscope with a K2 summit that we added in 2013. And I'd still advocate that if your group can have access to one microscope, this is the sort of thing you want a lot of access to. However, as at the previous NREM meeting, that Bridget pointed out, that everything just gets easier with a Titan Krios. So the current instrument that we've installed just a couple of months ago, we've put in our Titan Krios. Currently with a Falcon 3, we have a Quantum K2 on a different instrument that we might move over and upgrade to the K3, although it's not clear when that will happen. But the reason why I say that the primary instrument that you need access to is something like that, or this and an even lower end microscope, is the hierarchy of time that you spend in different experiments. And I'm biasing my comments towards single particle EM. The tomographers will realize that this is not exactly true for tomography experiments. But if you're starting off a new biological project, you'll spend a huge amount of time iterating between the biochemistry and checking the specimen in negative stain, back and forth. And you spend a lot of time there. And then once you've got a good negative stain specimen, then you'd move to screening. And there you might want a 200 kV FEG with direct detector. But you don't need high throughput. And that's where you're going to spend the second largest amount of time. And it's only when you're collecting the final resolution data set that you absolutely need the highest end instrument. So in my own lab up until now, we've accessed Titan Krioses by the generosity of Niko Grigoryev at Genalia and Clint and Bridget at NREM. And we've had a total of 4 sessions for the 4 papers that we've produced for the Titan Krios, with Titan Krios data. But given that you have a direct detector microscope, you have to also choose how you use that microscope efficiently. So if you have something like an F20 microscope, and here I'm biasing my comments to the FEI microscopes that completely dominate our field at the moment, with something like an F20, it's a 200 kV microscope with a side-entry cryo holder, in order to get the best performance out of it, you need to set up the illumination appropriately. So to get a parallel beam, you need to choose the combination of C2 aperture and lens settings that will minimize beam divergence. And this is a topic that Bob Glazer has written about, and it's also a topic I've presented on at previous NREM meetings, and you can find my slides online. The F20 microscope also will have hysteresis of lenses as you go up and down in magnification, and to avoid that, when you're doing a search mode, a low magnification mode, you have to sort of trick the microscope into not changing its lens powers too much, and you do that by using an over-focused diffraction pattern instead of a low magnification mode. If your microscope is a Talos or a Talos Arctica, difference being whether you're using a side entry holder or an autoloader, you still need to set up the lenses to avoid, to produce parallel illumination. Because this microscope design is still only a 2 condenser lens microscope. However, the Talos has a constant power objective lens, and so it can avoid some of the lens hysteresis, and you don't have to worry about that quite so much with the Talos architecture. For the F30 and the Polara being the microscope that Ifon's lab has used very successfully for high-resolution structures, you don't have the constant power lens. You need to use the over-focused diffraction pattern if you're going to go into low magnification, if you want to avoid lens hysteresis. And you also don't have a 3rd condenser lens, so you need to produce parallel illumination with the right combination of condenser aperture and condenser lens settings. If you move to a Titan Halo, you start to get a lot of advantages. So it's 300 kV, side-entry cryo holder, but you have this very useful 3rd condenser lens so that you can keep the illumination parallel at every setting of the beam, and constant power lenses so you can move up and down in magnification without significant lens hysteresis. And then, of course, there's the Titan Krios where you have the autoloader and everything just becomes a lot easier. The microscope becomes extremely stable. Now, one thing to bear in mind if you are changing between microscopes for different experiments is the different voltage produces different effects. High energy electrons will go through a specimen with a smaller interaction, a smaller scattering cross-section than low energy electrons. So in order to produce the same amount of signal, you need to use more electrons. Similarly, the contrast transfer function will be different at different voltages. So I hear quite often that, oh, I get better contrast at low voltage. And often what that means is the person doesn't know that they need to adapt their imaging conditions when they go to higher voltage. So what I've given here is just some tables from previous lectures I've given at NREM that show you how to calculate equivalent exposures and equivalent defocuses as you change between voltages. So for example, if you have collected data at 200 kV and you want to produce the same number of scattering events as you move to a 300 kV microscope, you need to use 20% more electrons in your exposure to produce the same signal. If you have collected your data at 200 kV and you want to produce the same CTF, you need to apply 27% more defocus. And if you don't do these things, it'll look like you have a lower contrast image. There are fewer scattered electrons, and your CTF doesn't emphasize the low resolution information as well. So you do need to compensate for these things. Now, what I really want to go over for the bulk of my lecture is how you decide on the various settings you use once you have, once you start acquiring data with your direct detector. So you're going to need to decide on the magnification that you use, or equivalently, how big your pixels are, and the phenomena, or the concepts that you need to understand to make that decision in a reasonable way is you need to understand detective quantum efficiency, the Nyquist limit, aliasing, and anisotropic magnification, and I will talk about some of those topics. You need to decide the exposure rate, as in how many electrons you're hitting the sensor with per pixel per second. And to make that decision rationally, you need to understand the phenomenon of coincidence loss. You need to decide how many frames per second you want to use in your DDD movie. And for deciding on that, you need to understand about aligning frames, the movement that occurs within frames, and radiation damage that occurs within each frame of your movie. And then you need to decide the total movie exposure in seconds. And for that, we need to think about the total signal that we can get at different resolutions with different exposures. So I want to start first with a refresher on some Fourier basics that will make the explanations that follow a bit more coherent. So our images are, of course, arrays of numbers. Here's a simple image that's 6 pixels by 6 pixels. And at each position in the image, there's a real number represented by A. And we're going to often work with the Fourier transforms of these images. When we calculate the Fourier transforms, we convert to an array of complex numbers. At each position in this array of complex numbers, we have a value like A plus BI, the general form of a complex number, where A is real, B is real, and I is a square root of negative 1. So we represent the Fourier transform as this array. Now, if this is a real array, if all the numbers here are real, and you can, of course, do more complicated mathematics that are irrelevant to us most of the time, where we're doing the Fourier transform of a complex array, but if these are all real numbers, there's a very important property for this Fourier transform, and that is it is Hermitian. For every position here, the number a plus bi, let's say 7 plus 3i, there'll be a corresponding number across from the origin that's 7 minus 3i. And so because of this Hermitian symmetry, we don't need to record all the numbers in the Fourier transform. Also, the numbers at the highest resolutions are real. They don't have an imaginary part. So when we write down the Fourier transform of a real array, we can ignore all of this region, and all the information we need is represented over here. And I've just restated the points over here. So Fourier transforms of real functions are Hermitian, and for an n by n image, the Fourier transform is n over 2 plus 1 by n complex numbers. Another thing I want to remind you of is that we can represent waves as vectors. So here's an arbitrary sine wave, and the parameters we need to know to describe the sine wave are the amplitude and its wavelength. But you'll see that this sine wave has the same amplitude and same wavelength, but isn't the same sine wave. And that's because it has a different phase. It has a different shift from some arbitrarily chosen origin. So the numbers that we need to represent that wave fully are the amplitude, wavelength, and phase. And we can represent the amplitude and phase for a wave of specified wavelength as a vector, where the length of the vector corresponds to the amplitude, and the angle it makes with this x-axis corresponds to the phase. And this vector can be represented by a complex number, where this is the real axis, this is the imaginary axis. So suddenly, this vector is explained by A plus BI. So that's exactly what we're doing in our Fourier transforms. That's why every pixel has the form A plus BI. It corresponds to a complex number, it corresponds to a vector that describes a wave. And the Fourier transform is simply the sum of many waves. The function is represented by many waves of different wavelengths, and each one having a different amplitude and a different phase. So for this particular Fourier transform, we just have these peaks, where each different wave has a form A plus BI. And one thing that you can see is that as you shift a wave, all you're doing is changing its phase. So the vector that represents it just rotates about the origin. And so if you shift a function, you're shifting all of the component waves that add up to form that function. But the amount of phase change that each one of these waves goes through is different. This wave that has a long wavelength has not gone through a full wavelength change as you shifted it, whereas this high-frequency wave has cycled around the origin several times as you shift it. And so shifting in real space causes phase changes in Fourier space, and each frequency goes through a different phase change. And then just taking this to two dimensions, each pixel corresponds to a two-dimensional wave now, with the wavelength determined by the position of the pixel and the direction of the wave corresponding to where the pixel is in the Fourier transform. And so we just add up all of these waves to produce the function that we got from the real image. So the first phenomenon I want to talk about is detective quantum efficiency, and that's of course going to be used for deciding what pixel size and what magnification you use. And people, it's actually not trivial to produce these curves of detective quantum efficiency, but what they're telling you is how efficient the detector is at detecting information at different frequencies. So the definition of detective quantum efficiency is the signal-to-noise ratio that is recorded by the sensor divided by the signal-to-noise ratio that was coming in. Now, why would the signal-to-noise ratio that's about to hit the sensor be anything but perfect? Well, we're doing low-dose imaging. And so we've got a lot of statistical noise in that wavefront that's produced as the electron beam goes through the specimen. So it's not a perfect signal-to-noise ratio coming in. And the detector, of course, can't make that imperfect SNR perfect, but all it can do is make it worse. And so what we're plotting here is how much worse the signal-to-noise ratio gets at every spatial frequency. So right near the origin, we're talking about very low spatial frequencies, and basically asking the question, for every electron that comes in, are we counting it or are we not counting it? If we're counting it, we would get 100%, but we never get 100%. And as you get to higher and higher resolution, you're asking, how accurately are we able to place that electron? Can we get it down to one pixel accuracy, right over here? Or can we get it down to two pixels accuracy, et cetera? So we're saying, how accurately are we recording the electrons, and how accurately are we placing them on the sensor? And if we just had a detector that sat there integrating electrons, it would never look perfect because of this phenomenon that I think was extremely strikingly shown in this paper by Greg McMullen and Richard Henderson and Wazi Faruqi. So this image shows individual electron impact events on a direct detector. And you can see that some electrons put this little blip, and some electrons put this big sort of blob. And because of that, the detective quantum efficiency of the sensor is decreased. And the answer to that problem is to normalize the signal from each electron. So essentially, if each electron is putting in a variable signal, what we want to do is replace that variable signal with a count and say, that was one electron, even though there's a big signal, and that was one electron, and this sort of blob was one electron. And so counting electrons, as done on the K2 or the Falcon 3, dramatically improves the detective quantum efficiency. Now, the next phenomenon I want to talk about is aliasing. And this comes to the idea of the Nyquist frequency. So if we have a wave, and it's an analog signal, the lowest frequency that we can sample this wave is, and still detect that it was a sine wave, is once at the peak and once at the trough, and then once at the peak and once at the trough. So we need to sample this wave with twice the frequency of the wave in order to detect that it was indeed a sine wave. And this leads us to the concept of critical sampling and the Nyquist frequency, where if we sample with one angstrom pixels, the highest resolution wave that we could record is a 2-angstrom wave. But this sort of critical sampling or Nyquist sampling is kind of dangerous, because if I shift the wave even slightly, or half a wavelength, suddenly our samples all lie at zero. So you can see where this line crossed the wave is all at zero, and we would miss this particular wave completely with this sampling frequency. So generally, if you want 2-angstrom resolution information, you should be sampling more frequently than 1-angstrom. If you want 3-angstroms, you should be sampling more frequently than 1.5-angstroms. Now, a problem occurs when there are waves that are higher frequency than you're sampling. So let's take this wave, that's critical sampling, let's take this wave that's higher frequency than our sampling, and sample it at the same frequency as we did these waves. Now we're looking at where does this high frequency wave cross our sampling lines. You can see it's here, and here, and here, and here. And if we connect those points, we've produced a low frequency wave. And so actually having higher frequency information than you're sampling doesn't disappear from your image, it gets aliased. You contribute a low frequency wave to your image that starts to corrupt your image. And in fact, So we produce, we start to alias our image. And in fact, if we have spectral power that looks like this, but our sampling frequency limits our Nyquist to here, so we've got one angstrom sampling, and this then corresponds to two angstroms, all of the spectral power in the analogy that I've shown you, which I'll tell you in a moment is not completely real, all of the spectral power gets folded in to the power spectrum and starts to degrade our image. Now, the reason why this isn't quite real, and this is something that didn't quite sit with me for a long time, and it wasn't until some conversations with Marcus, who's not quite here, that I finally figured out what was going wrong in my thinking, is that we're not sampling an analog signal with infinitely small points with our pixel detectors. We're actually adding up the signal that occurs in each pixel. So we're not sampling over here. We're integrating the signal within each pixel, and that leads to a more complicated aliasing pattern that I don't want to get into. So the higher frequency waves then produce a low frequency signal, but it's not exactly the same as that analog signal with infinitely small sampling points. And excuse me. Because of this aliasing, the detective quantum efficiency of a direct detector device is never going to be perfect at high resolution. But there are a couple of tricks that are used by the different manufacturers to avoid the aliasing. For example, what's done with the K2 detector is the real pixels, which I've indicated in green, are divided into four imaginary pixels, what they call super resolution. And what the algorithm of the K2 summit tries to do is localize the electron impact event not to a real pixel, a physical pixel, but based on how the energy is spreading to the different physical pixels, it tries to localize it to a corner of a physical pixel. So it's gone from this electron contributing to a physical pixel and trying to localize it to a corner of that physical pixel. And so what we do, or the strategy that I'd recommend with one of these, if you're going to use the super resolution mode, is you collect your data in super resolution mode, you calculate the Fourier transform, the high resolution information that would have otherwise been aliased is now outside, is way out here, and then you just crop out the part of the Fourier transform that corresponds to the physical pixels, you're throwing away all that signal, you put it in a new array, and then calculate, you back transform to calculate the image that you would have acquired if you had actually used the physical pixels. And this should be free of some of those aliasing artifacts. Now, you could also try to use the information that's recorded in the super resolution mode. And this is the K2 summit detective quantum efficiency out to the physical Nyquist, and then there's the super resolution information that continues. But the thing to remember is that the detective quantum efficiency of the super resolution pixels is super low detective quantum efficiency. So I would say don't try to use that in a reconstruction. Don't say, well, my super resolution Nyquist is 2 angstroms, so I'm going to try to build a model at 2.1 angstroms. Just concentrate on the information within your physical pixel Nyquist. You may be able to reduce aliasing by doing this Fourier truncation. But super resolution data collection takes longer and uses additional disk space. And realistically, the advantage that you get from collecting in the super resolution mode followed by Fourier truncation, that the boost in detective quantum efficiency probably isn't worthwhile. And I think the decision that's been made at places like NRAM and MyLab also is that you're better off collecting in counting mode because it gives you more data faster. And that's better than getting perhaps a slightly better detective quantum efficiency in each image. I should point out that if you take your super resolution mode and then average your pixels 2 by 2, you've reintroduced that aliasing and there's no benefit. So Fourier truncation may have a benefit, averaging 2 by 2 doesn't. And Rado Danev did a very nice calculation a little while ago. If you're not on Twitter, you're missing a lot of cryo-EM, where he compared a super resolution data set where he processed it by Fourier truncation versus 2 by 2 binning, and the advantage of the Fourier truncation, which gets rid of the aliasing, over the 2 by 2 binning, which reintroduces the aliasing, was almost invisible. And perhaps the variability came from other noise in the classification. So I think you're better off not worrying about super resolution as a way of reducing aliasing. The Falcon 3 has a different way of reducing aliasing. And incidentally, this, I'm not exactly sure what the Falcon 3 is doing. We've only been playing with it for a month or so. And this is what we've sort of reverse engineered by looking at, or deduced by looking at what the data. So what we think it's doing, and if there's someone from FEI or someone who knows what FEI is doing, they could correct me, is you acquire your images with a low exposure so that your electrons are well separated. And then, again, you have the real physical pixels in green and the super resolution pixels that are in black, and you localize your electrons to a corner of a pixel, but you don't record this image. Instead, you place some sort of function, perhaps a Gaussian, at that corner of the pixel. And this adding of a Gaussian is a real space way of performing this anti-aliasing. You then write down the numbers of this approximation of a Gaussian so that you have the numbers recorded from each electron into each physical pixel, and this is what you record. So you never record the super resolution image, it's the counting algorithm that inherently does the anti-aliasing for you. The advantage is that you get any possible benefit of anti-aliasing without the problems of the time of recording a larger image and having to do the Fourier truncation later. A possible disadvantage, I'm not sure if that's true, we're just playing with it now, is that because you're introducing a lot of numbers that aren't ones, twos, threes, the ability to compress your data appears to be somewhat reduced. Although, it's not like we're introducing random numbers. You'll see that these patterns all consist of the same numbers, just in different orientations, depending on which corner of the pixel the electrons went into. So this idea of counting is important. I'd say that every detector in the near future will be doing counting. It's essential for getting your best possible detective quantum efficiency. But it also introduces constraints into how you acquire the images. And that constraint is in order to avoid the phenomenon of coincidence loss. This is an easy image to count. You can see where the electrons are. But imagine you're an algorithm trying to figure out where the electrons are here. And all you're seeing is the sums of these different electron impact events. If the algorithm decides that this was one really smeared out electron, you will have missed 4 out of the 5 electrons that hit the sensor. And you start to suffer from this phenomenon of coincidence loss. So in order to avoid having too many electrons hitting the sensor, we need to limit our exposure rate to the point where we can actually have a reasonable chance of distinguishing every separate electron. And Richard Henderson will tell you that that number should be about 1 electron per 100 pixels per movie frame where you're trying to do counting. Yes?
John, how does shot noise affect these counting events?
So this electronic signal to noise of these detectors is very high. So, and actually, sorry, it's getting even higher. The DE detector is extremely good electronics. I think the Falcon 3 also looks very good. So I don't think you're going to see much electronic shot noise. Are you talking about shot noise in the image formation? So that's your image. That's the incoming wavefront that you can't do anything about. That's your SNR in. So it's not going to affect the DQE. It's just inherent limitation. The detector can't improve that. OK, so 1 electron for every 100 pixels, that is actually a very low exposure rate. And if you think about the frame rate of the different cameras, that means that you have to start taking extremely slow exposures. So with a K2 that runs at 400 frames a second, that exposure rate would correspond to 4 electrons per pixel per second, which is slower than what most people are using. The K3, 1,500 frames per second, that's actually a fairly reasonable 15 electrons per pixel per second, higher than most people are using with the K2. The Falcon 3, that's 0.4 electrons per pixel per second, and the DE20, that's about 0.3 electrons per pixel per second. Now, people have found by experience that you can go higher than this and still get good resolution structures at the end, which of course is what we care about. And for the K2, people are using exposure rates in this range. I'm told NRAM, it doesn't seem to make a difference to the final resolution of some of their control specimens. And then keeping that statistic, this is what it looks like on a K3 or a Falcon 3. And in fact, for the Falcon 3, for their high resolution apoferritin structure from FEI, they use something near the top end of this range as exposure rate, and then for the DE20. So one of the consequences of these low exposure rates, this is still extremely low, is you can't have the specimen stage moving a lot during this time. So if you're going to use something like a Falcon 3 or a DE20, you need a very stable very stable stage. And actually, we can do that with a Titan Krios. So our Titan Krios, we were acquiring images over 90 seconds, a minute and a half, and saw 5 angstroms of drift over a minute and a half. I'm told not all Titan Krioses are quite that stable. Amadei. Sorry, the getting a good detective quantum efficiency?
Getting limiting the coincidence loss.
So I'm but a little confused.
It basically, you improve the contrast, so you don't really affect the high resolution.
So I'm thinking on my feet here to a paper from Ifan and David that showed DQE curves at different exposure rates and showed the DQE benefiting more at low resolution, which would be better for small particles.
And the coincidence loss affects the low frequencies
more. Right, so that's the phenomenon.
So
that's right. So right, for small particles where you need the low frequency information more, the coincidence loss is more affected at low resolution. So yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, but if I remember correctly, in Ifan's paper, they measured not much effect on the DQE. It was just amplitude effect at the low frequencies.
Okay.
So the signal to noise was not affected much. It was just that the low frequencies were kind of attenuated. And I'm puzzled by that still, because you know coincidence loss means you lose some information.
Yeah,
and
should.
In their paper, they didn't see much of an effect. So it's
yeah. So I'm
a
not clear
puzzling.
On that either. It's a bit it's a bit puzzling why it should be low resolution. Okay, now I want to move on to the topic of frame alignment, because you've acquired all these frames. If, as I just said, if you had a specimen moving a lot during each frame, that's information you're never going to get back. The best you can do is fix the movement between frames, not the intra-frame motion. And of course, the reason why you're doing frame alignment is to restore the coherence in your image, to make sure the particles in each frame can actually be averaged coherently when you put the frames together. So if you look at the power spectrum from an unaligned movie, you can get something like this. Whereas if you align the movie, your power spectrum becomes symmetric and you've restored the information appropriately. And what I want to do is go through the different algorithms that have been developed in order to solve this problem of frame alignment. And I'll start actually with an algorithm that I don't think many people are using anymore from Zhumeng Li, but it's actually, I think, one of the most elegant algorithms, and it really appeals to me, and I was very, very impressed when I went through the paper and went through the exercise of writing a CPU version of this. It's very, very satisfying to see, so I'm very impressed by Zhumeng's work. Essentially, what Zhumeng in Ifan's group realized is that for a simple unlined movie, let's take one of four frames, you can calculate the alignment by cross-correlation between all these different pairs of frames to get your aligned movie. So you can calculate a shift vector between any two pairs of frames, so let's say this first frame and second frame, and this first frame and third frame, in order to bring them into register. And you can do that by calculating the cross-correlation coefficient. And for this movie of four frames, you can calculate six unique cross-correlation coefficients. So you can do frame 1 versus 2, frame 1 versus 3, frame 1 versus 4, 2 versus 3, 2 versus 4, 3 versus 4. And that statistic gets even better as your number of frames goes up. So if you have z frames, you can calculate z over 2 times z minus 1 cross-correlation coefficients. You can make this number of unique measurements of cross-correlation. So for 30 frames, which is how we typically collect data in my lab on the F20K2, you can calculate 435 cross-correlation coefficients. However, you don't need that many numbers in your alignment. For instance, going back to our four-frame movie, we only need three numbers. We need to know the translation from frame 1 to 2, from frame 2 to 3, and from frame 3 to 4. For 30 frames, you just need 29 translations to figure out how to align the movies. But you've got a very large number of measurements. And so what Zhumeng realized is that you can write down this system as a matrix of, you can write down the system of equations as matrices so that the measurement you made should be, for frame 1 to 2, should be just the translation from frame 1 to 2. Whereas the measurement you made from, and would write that line in this matrix over here, so as you multiply matrices, 1 times this plus 0 times this plus 0 times this should be that. For frame 1 to 3 over here, you should have this plus this, or this line in your matrix, and then you can go through and fill up this matrix with numbers or ones and zeros that give you all of the possible equations. And now you have a very large system of equations, and you can use standard linear algebra to figure out the least squares fit for these unknowns that you really care about that best explain your large number of measurements. And there's some nice little tricks introduced to make that data a little bit cleaner. And that can very accurately determine the translations from each frame to the next with sub-pixel precision. Because even though you're making your measurements with pixel precision, or perhaps some improvements he made with sub-pixel precision, you're actually doing this least squared fit that can get you a very accurate measurement. Unfortunately, the limitation of the motion core algorithm is that you're comparing individual noisy frames to other individual noisy frames. And so these numbers are always going to be quite noisy. Alexi and Tim, am I right? And Nico? Tim? Tim and Nico are the ones that introduced the unblur algorithm. And that's a nice, simple, elegant algorithm where, and this is actually a little bit nerve-wracking, presenting other people's algorithms in front of them. let's see if I get it right. Where you take your movie, you remove one of the frames, you sum up the remaining frames, and then you align the frame that you removed to the sum of frames, and then put it back in, and then repeat the process for all frames, and then fit those positions with a spline to make sure that it's a smooth trajectory of frames, and then repeat the process. Good. until you converge and the movement from iteration to iteration stops. The algorithm that I introduced with some help from Marcus Brubaker was to use this approach of gradient-based optimization, where you come up with one number that tells you how well your frames are aligned. So when that single number, that single objective function is minimized, you've maximized the sum of the correlation of each shifted frame with the sum of the shifted frames. So you have this objective function that tells it, here's the space of all the possible shifts of all the frames. Each frame has two possible shifts you can have, so it's a very large space. 30 frames means 60 parameter space. You come up with this one number, but the important thing is the way you phrase this problem is such that you can also calculate the derivative of this objective function, so that when you measure the function, you can also tell which way it is towards the bottom. And computer scientists like Marcus and others for many years before him have spent a lot of time developing optimization algorithms that, given an objective function and a derivative, or the matrix of first derivatives that we call the gradient, that tells you which way is down, you can very effectively find the minimum of this function that tells you the best way to align all of these images. And there are all these algorithms that have been developed. The BFGS is the one that we implemented in this align frames. And this all works out quite nicely because of the way things work in Fourier space, where if we take the Fourier transform of our frames, this is the original coordinate of the jth pixel in the zth, or the zth frame of a movie. The shift due to shifting the frame, the phase change due to shifting the frame causes this Fourier component to change like so. We can represent this phase change over here, and or like this. And the other convenient thing is that the Fourier transform of the sum of images is equal to the sum of the Fourier transforms of the images. So we can represent that over here. And we can write down a very simple objective function that's simply the correlation of the shifted frame with the sum of the shifted frames. We just sum up over all frames and over all pixels, make it negative so that we minimize this function, and we can also calculate partial derivatives. Now, those are whole frame alignment algorithms, and those will get you some of the way to high resolution. If you zoom in, if you go to very high magnification, whole frame is probably the only thing you ever need, because the ice will move kind of coherently. But if you have a larger field of view, or ice that moves in a very anisotropic way, then you'll benefit from having algorithms that concentrate on smaller regions. So the equivalent of the whole frame movement that we wrote was this aligned parts algorithm. Shorge introduced the polishing scheme in Relion. And Sean Zhang in David Agard's lab introduced the Motion Core 2 algorithm that's extremely popular and powerful. So for particle polishing, essentially what we do is we take our stack of unaligned frames, and now each frame corresponds to an individual particle. But the signal-to-noise ratio in every frame for every particle is extremely low. So the first step is to do whole frame alignment, to get rid of the bulk of the motion. So now polishing just worries about the little bit of intra-particle variability in direction. That whole frame shift has been removed by using something like Motion Core or Motion Core 2, or unblur, or align frames. So the next step is then to do a rolling average. So rather than trying to align frame 1 with anything, because the signal-to-noise ratio is so low, polishing will average groups of frames. So actually, rather than frame 1, we'll say frame 2 will be replaced by the average of frame 1, 2, and 3. Frame 3 will be replaced by the average of frame 2, 3, and 4. And even though those frames aren't aligned yet, we can average them to boost the signal to noise. And they're not so misaligned, because they're adjacent frames, that we can actually average them somewhat coherently. So now we have these rolling averages of frames that we can use in projection matching with a reference map. And this is where polishing is unique, because it's the only algorithm that will use the 3D structure to try to fix the motion that's occurring in the data. This is an advantage, because the 3D structure is very high signal to noise. And so the projections of the 3D structure are extremely high signal to noise. It's a disadvantage in that you've got to keep your movie data along the entire processing pipeline right to the end. And also, I guess there's a possible disadvantage that if your image happens to have an extra bit of contamination that's not represented in your model, that could confuse the polishing procedure. So now that you've aligned the individual rolling averages of frames to the projections of the map, you can fit them to a straight line. So polishing presumes that particles move with constant velocity in constant direction, and the position of a particle in a frame will be the starting position plus whatever that constant velocity in constant direction is times the frame number. So particles are taking even steps along in a constant direction. And then to improve those linear trajectories for particles, you go through your micrograph and you say that nearby particles should have similar trajectories. So you do the sort of local averaging of the parameters for those linear fits. And you end up with these sorts of vectors that are straight lines, constant velocity for each particle. Motion Core 2 effectively uses an unblur approach to align the whole frame. And then you divide the frame into different patches and then use an unblur approach for the individual patches. But then you start to fit those trajectories to a polynomial model that specifies you come up with the fit for this trajectory for an individual patch to a model, so that you can now go to a pixel in between the centers of the patches and say, given my model, what must the motion have been for those pixels? And based on this, you can actually define the shift for every single pixel and then warp your image so that all of the images in the movie stack should align well. And one of the really nice things about this approach is that you then end up with a single average of frames that has all the corrections done in it. You don't have to keep your movies. And it's a very efficient way of storing data, and which is, of course, a problem for many of us. Aligned parts is exactly like aligned frames, except the optimization approach is accurate enough that it can align a patch that's about 200 pixels or even less. So you can find out that you can find the trajectories for individual particles. We add a constraint that the trajectories have to be smooth when you find their trajectories. And then we also do the sort of local averaging, basically equivalent to what Reliant is doing, saying that nearby particles have to have nearby trajectories. And you can see that particles over here have one trajectory, and particles over here have another trajectory. So there are many different pipelines that you can use for your data processing. And to give you an example of one pipeline that's worked extremely effectively for us, we had a structure where a collaborator sent us some protein. Samir Benlikber in my lab collected data on our F20 and optimized the image acquisition with the F20K2. He used aligned frames for aligning whole frames, calculating CTFs with CTF find, and then aligned parts for the individual particle data set. And with CryoSpark, got a map at around 5 angstroms. Our collaborator then wrote an application for NRAM and was awarded some time at NRAM. A data set was collected in 24 hours on Titan Krios, the K2, and Motion Core 2 was used, and that led to a CryoSpark map at 3.4 angstroms. It was a beautiful pipeline, I think the picture of efficiency. But the point that I want to make is that one size doesn't fit all, and it's not like this motion correction problem is fully solved. We had a recent structure in the lab, actually just came out last week, where Hui Guo collected data on our F20K2. He got about 250,000 particles, used line parts, and got a map at 4.4 angstroms resolution. We then talked to Bridget and Clint, got some time at NRAM. Hui collected data for 3 days on the Krios 2, I think, with a K2, a quantum K2. About 500,000 particles were collected, Motion Core 2, and the map went to 4.5 angstroms resolution. And we freaked out. I think Bridget and Clint also freaked out. They quickly did a Somebody at NREM quickly did a 2.6 angstrom resolution structure of apoferritin to make sure the microscope was working properly. And we're worried about all the data, wondering why does every image have 10% astigmatism? Is something wrong here? And we really worried for quite a long time until I convinced Hui, or I didn't have to convince him, I said, let's just try aligned parts. I know we've done well with MotionCore 2, but with aligned parts, the structure right away went to 3.6 angstroms resolution. And so that was the structure of the mitochondrial FO region that was just published last week. So my point here is not that this is going to solve all your problems. I do not make that promise. I'm sure there are examples where aligned parts has made structures significantly worse. But my point is that you should not consider this a solved problem. And just like Yifan said on the first day, if something doesn't work, try something else. And there are other things to try. OK, so to summarize the different algorithms that are available, there's MotionCore. It's a frame alignment algorithm. It's correlating noisy frames with other noisy frames, and it smooths that those trajectories by using this powerful least squares approach. And the advantage is that the problem is highly overdetermined. 30 frames gives you 435 different measurements. The disadvantage is that you're comparing low signal-to-noise frames to other low signal-to-noise frames. There's UnBlur, which is frame alignment. It's now comparing noisy frames to the sums of noisy frames that are less noisy. And it's smoothing that with a trajectory fit. To a spline. The disadvantage is it's a robust alignment algorithm. That's the advantage. The disadvantage is that it is whole frame alignment. So you may be losing some information if that's all you use. Aligned frames also compares noisy frames to the sums of noisy frames. It smooths by penalizing changes in the trajectory, or what we call second order smoothing. The advantage is it's relatively fast and robust, but the disadvantage is it's still only a whole frame alignment algorithm. Polishing compares noisy, it's a particle alignment algorithm, it compares noisy images of individual particles to the extremely high signal-to-noise projection of a 3D map. It smooths that with a linear fit, the rolling average, and the enforcement of local correlation. The advantage is that that projection of a map is extraordinarily high signal-to-noise. The disadvantage is that your individual particle may not be well explained by that map. Maybe a different conformation, may have a bit different bit of contamination, or might be a slightly different might be a slightly broken particle. Aligned parts is particle alignment. It's comparing the noisy particles to the sums of noisy particles that are slightly less noisy. Smooths with second order smoothing. And the advantage is they can have non-linear trajectories. The disadvantage is that map projections, compared to polishing, the map projections will have a higher signal-to-noise ratio. And finally, there's MotionCore 2, where it's comparing regions rather than particles or whole frames. It's comparing the noisy patches to the sums of those noisy patches, smooths with this polynomial fit. The advantage is it can be extraordinarily fast and efficient. The disadvantage, I understand from some others, is that if a patch contains nothing, it's going to have a random motion, and that can throw off some of your other patches. So I've heard that for filaments it can be problematic, and Amadei has a comment or question. I am. Yeah, this is not. There are probably about five other approaches. I don't know anyone using the optical flow method, so I couldn't. And I don't know much about it myself. Okay, so that takes care of the motion between frames. What about the radiation damage that's occurring during the frames? For me, the Ivan.
Different kind of related question. That still about the motion question, regardless of which algorithm, have you tried really using a very short exposure, a frame, and very short, the shortest one, whatever you can get, and then can see if it can still, any of this algorithm can still or work, but or using your rolling averaging.
Yeah.
The main problem for all this algorithm that except the rolling averaging is that once you're using short and short exposure, that each frame
has less
became an insufficient sampling, and then you have a high frequency, very strong high frequency data signal, or noise or whatever, but low frequency information is very poor, and then your alignment became harder and harder.
Yeah.
And then have you ever tried?
So we haven't intentionally gone to too low exposure, but we have accidentally gone to too low exposure. So when we did our first data collection with the Falcon 3, standard settings for, we didn't explore different conditions, different algorithms, but with aligned parts, nothing worked. until Zev Ripstein was a student in the lab, he just kept on boosting up the smoothing power until it actually seemed to, once you forced enough smoothing, it picked up on the signal and worked. But actually, as Seth Darts commented just a moment ago, the problem with this algorithm is you've got to manually find that parameter that gives you trajectories that you like and think are reasonable. And we have some intuition for how to do that, but it's really not that rigorous. So we have accidentally found conditions that didn't work and then found ways of making them work, but we haven't intentionally explored trying to push the algorithm. I should say that with aligned parts, we noticed that we might be looking at a 200 kilodalton particle, and the particle picks a tiny piece of garbage somewhere in the image. It has almost no signal, as far as we can tell, but it gets a reasonable trajectory. And this surprises me, because there's very little signal. I think that second-order smoothing is extremely powerful, saying, I don't care what your trajectory is, as long as it's smooth. And then that gets rid of a lot of the space of unreasonable trajectories, picks up on the little bit of signal in the image, and then gets a reasonable trajectory in the end. Is another question?
Yeah, I think Motion Core 2 has the option for moving average. So in principle, you can collect with tons of frames. And the question is there an advantage, and you know how much an advantage there is when you go smaller and smaller in the exposure per frame? And that's, I guess, for the future. And
right. So the advantage, of course, is that you should have less intra-frame motion. You should also have more precise correction of radiation damage. But yeah, there's a lot of, I think we're finally getting to the stage after the, like most revolutions, the resolution revolution has been kind of chaotic. We're finally getting to the stage where we can actually start to sit down and think and do careful experiments rather than just cleaning up the stuff we have to do.
Yeah, I have a comment here. Basically, that a lot of time when we are doing a tilted data collection or when we are using faceplate, we are reducing the frame time. Because for tilted data collection, there are still some drift. So when you reduce that and you change the parameter on the motion core 2, you can get it online a lot of time. Again, it's always your specimen dependent. If you can get a good contrast images in those, I think the best we have is probably about 0.5 or 0.3 electrons per frame. So.
Shall we do the discussion now or at the end of the talk? You just finished the frame alignment portion, so maybe
one
more comment. So I'm not sure if I'm not remembering correctly if Motion Core had the option to specify boxes as an initial parameter, in a sense that if you remove the background noise portion of the image and only use the box particles as information for the alignment, will that improve the
So I don't know. We've actually never used Motion Core in my lab. The processing of Motion Core that was done as part of the pipeline at NREM.
But do you think that will improve the performance of all these?
So the person, my go-to person for understanding optimization algorithms, is Marcus. This is his bread and butter, and I believe he's told me that the iterative approach versus the gradient-based approach should converge on the same solution. The gradient-based approach should get there faster, but they should ultimately get the same answer. So I don't see why that wouldn't work. I don't see why.
It's not a question of the algorithm. I think using only the particles area and not using the background noise areas for the alignment.
I think that I don't know if that's an option. That should work. It should work as well as aligned parts.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Can I move on? So. Okay, well now let's talk about radiation damage. And for me, this a question of radiation damage and optimal exposure, I started thinking about it in around the year 2000 at a EMBO course in Heidelberg where Vincenz Unger and Werner Kulbrandt were arguing about this question. And it made me go back, and I found this paper from Bob Glaser and Hayward. Who's Hayward? Sorry?
Steve
Hayward. And what Bob and Steve had done was think about the signal-to-noise ratio as a function of electron exposure at a given resolution. And they reasoned that if you start off with the boundary conditions, if you don't use any electrons, you have no signal in your image. as you contribute more electrons to your image, the signal-to-noise ratio goes out until eventually you've destroyed that structure at that resolution, and then each additional electron just contributes noise. There's still information from the previous electrons, but you just contribute noise. And based on a number of assumptions that I've never questioned, and I wonder whether some of them should be revisited at this point about how the detector behaves, you can work out the optimal exposure as a function of the exposure that leads to a diffraction spot decreasing to 1 over E times its initial intensity. And what really boggled my mind around 2010, I was working with my graduate student, Lindsay Baker, and we were trying to get the structure of ATP synthase. Then we were stuck at around 25 angstroms resolution. And all of the papers that we read about the right exposure to use, what was low-dose imaging, said it was 10 electrons per square angstrom or so. And that was the number that gave you the optimal exposure at 3 angstroms. But we were stuck at 20 angstroms. And we knew that the information at 15 angstroms and 10 angstroms would let us align our particles, and that was the information we wanted to optimize. So before you run, you walk, and we tried to figure out what was the right electron exposure to use to solve our problem, not the problem of today of getting atomic resolution structures. And so what Lindsay did, actually, with a summer student, Eric Smith, is we grew 2D crystals of catalase, repeating experiments that Bob and others had done, and acquired images with different electron exposures. This is on photographic film on our F20. And we acquired our first image with 8 electrons per angstrom squared. And right away, you can see there were diffraction spots in the calculated Fourier transform that go right out to 3 angstroms resolution. And then we kept on hitting the specimen with more and more electrons, recording these subsequent images until you start to see the high resolution information fade, and you're just left with a low resolution signal. And from there, we worked out these optimal weighting curves, where we measured this critical exposure, as Bob and Richard Henderson and Nigel had called it. And from there, you calculate with Bob's equations the optimal exposure. And we decided that we could use this curve to decide for the resolution where we're trying to optimize the signal to noise, we could choose an electron exposure to get the best possible signal to noise ratio there. This was 2010. There were no direct detectors. But Richard has been talking about direct detectors for about 20 years. And we put in our paper that we realized that each one of these curves would allow us to optimize the signal to noise at different resolutions if we recorded a movie. And that's exactly what has happened. Nico and Tim measured much better critical exposure curves, not using 2D crystals, but using icosahedral viruses. So dramatic improvement for single particles, because they're single particles. I'd say there's still work to be done, because icosahedral viruses are kind of weird single particles, where just like with a 2D crystal, as soon as you break the orientation of the crystal, you get an artificially depressing, pessimistic view of radiation damage. If you start to distort icosahedral virus, you get a similar depressing view of radiation damage, because you start to decrease resolution faster than you should. But these are much better curves measured on a direct detector with viruses at higher resolution. And basically, everybody is using these curves. Everybody who's doing the sort of physics-based exposure weighting are using Nico's curves. So we've originally implemented our curves in line parts, but then we switched them to Nico's curves that Nico and Tim kindly provided to us ahead of publication. They're the curves that are used for radiation damage weighting in Unblur, of course, but also in Motion Core 2. And doing this sort of radiation damage weighting, where you take the high resolution information from the early frames and the low resolution information from the average of the early and the late frames, leads to a reasonable improvement in resolution. It's not as much as I would have thought from the original experiments that we did, but it's helpful, and everything is helpful these days. The other approach to doing this sort of exposure weighting is the data-driven approach. And this really appeals to me. This is what Shorge introduced into RelyOn. And here, you don't decide based on physics how much radiation damage is occurring at each electron exposure, which assumes that all proteins are the same, everything behaves like a catalase crystal or a icosahedral virus, and it also assumes you know your exposure accurately, which many of us don't. But you ask the question, does each frame in a movie help or hurt at different resolutions? It's a data-driven approach. And when you do that, you similarly can upweight some frames and downweight other frames at different resolutions to optimize the signal-to-noise ratio at each spatial frequency. So the final topic that I want to cover, and it seems I've timed my lecture reasonably well, is this idea of magnification anisotropy. And this is important because I think it's a problem that many people have and few people know about. And anisotropic magnification is simply the observation that at certain conditions with your electron microscope, the magnification in one direction is different than the magnification in another direction. Magnification in X does not equal magnification in Y. This problem seems particularly pronounced when you have to use your microscope at low magnification. And you use your microscope at low magnification if you have a sensor with small pixels, that is, if you have a DE sensor or you have a K2 sensor. It doesn't happen with the Falcon sensor. The cynic will say that FEI doesn't care about fixing the problem because it doesn't happen with the FEI sensor. But I think they are actually making it better. And I'm not sure whether the more recent Krioses are better and have fewer anisotropic magnification issues. But the phenomenon is well known. In the early 2D crystal software, there was a parameter that had to...
Just, I guess, a comment on that. You can get them to fix it if you yell at them hard enough, I guess.
I understand that some people yelled quite hard and didn't have success in the early days.
I guess weren't David.
I understand that's...
Can you talk up, Chris?
It's just an alignment that they can do, the microscope company. So people who do very high-resolution diffraction in material science have to have this perfect all the time. Otherwise, they can't index their patterns properly.
But
so.
Not at these magnifications that we're talking about.
Right.
That's why the FEI doesn't usually...
So I understand Janalia had a very hard... Janalia, the problems have never been corrected instrumentally. And I know that in the 80s, this was a problem that also was never corrected. It was followed for about 15 years on an LMB microscope. And it was a parameter that was introduced into the 2D crystal processing package to correct for the anisotropic magnification. So it'd be interesting and great if they could do that. I'd like
John,
to follow up on that.
Maybe you could ask the audience, has anybody seen it on a newer Krios? Because ours are all well below 1%, I think, or
yeah,
below 1%, just below 1%.
Ifan's got a comment. Yeah. So let's have a response to that on a microphone.
Oh, thanks.
If I remember, in our Krios, that there is a measured anisotropic magnification, and this can be measured in the factory, and there is a special procedure they can do that, and then they can actually correct for that. And then there's certain parameter in the setting there, they can do that. And then in our case, they did this one, they gave us we put this as a part of acceptance test.
Okay.
And then they did this, and then they gave us the microscope, then we measured here, and they still have a much bigger anisotropic magnification. It turned out that they fix it, and they put a number, and when they shipped microscope or something, that number got lost, and it reset back to the original. And then they have to measure it again, and there's certain procedure, I don't know exactly, that they did measure in our site and then get that fixed. So now that I think it's below 0.some%, it's a very small number now. But it was initially it was like it's a very noticeable number, it's an unacceptable number. But in the factory, they can measure this one, they can fix it. And I don't know whether this can be fixed for all the magnification or it's just a specific number of magnification
right.
you define. That I don't know. I'm not clear. And then related to this one is that in Polora, we know that there's a problem in one specific magnification. And that magnification that is just bad. And that magnification is actually very good pixel size-wise for the camera, everything. And FEI refused to fix it because it's only affect K2 camera. And so they refuse to do anything. So we have to avoid that magnification. And I don't know whether this is still the case for the Krios. I didn't hear people talking about it. I don't remember, but I don't, yeah.
I don't know the specific, but I know there are two kinds of distortion that cause the anisotropy in magnification. One of it is from the objective lens, which they can tune when they are at the factory. The other type happens in the projection system, which is probably what the Janino had. So what happens is that there's one type they can easily fix. There's the other type that's harder to fix. So it's possible that we just run into two different kind of situation, which also explains why on some microscope it only happens in a particular magnification. Because the lens series that's being used is different for the projection system.
So we have spent some time now talking about solving the problem. There's some people in the audience who still don't understand what the problem is, I'm sure. So let me just wrap this up. I just have a few more slides. So this is an image of thallus chloride at low magnification on our F20. Thallus chloride, you can probably see these crystal lattice lines. If you calculate the Fourier transform, you have these diffraction spots. And the distance from the diffraction spot to the origin should depend on the lattice spacing. But if you average many of these crystals, you see a ring, each crystal contributing a different pair of spots. And if your magnification were the same in all directions, if you actually had that radius corresponding to the lattice spacing in all directions, you'd expect that to be a perfect circle. But you can see from our F20 image, the red is a perfect circle that matches the lines at the top and bottom, but you can see the lines are outside of the red on the left and right. The magnification is different in this direction than that direction. If you plot the radius as a function of angle around that circle, you get this pattern that we can fit to an ellipse, or an approximation of an ellipse. And the problem here is, imagine you had your Fourier ducts, or your specimen ducts, and they've been slightly stretched in one direction versus the other. If you then take these single particles and align them, or even subtomogram averages, and align them, even though they look very similar, with that stretch, they now will not align perfectly. There's no way to coherently average these ducts because of that distortion. So the solution is to take your image and stretch it. That will produce a circular diffraction pattern, and that will solve your problem. So there are a couple of different approaches that have been used to solve the anisotropic magnification problem. The simplest, in terms of workflow, although it produces extra files, is to take each frame of your movie and stretch it in the right direction. The best that I think hasn't been incorporated into any programs yet is to have it as a parameter in your refinement software that's doing tons of interpolation anyway, doesn't care if there's a little bit of stretching going on, but you better get it right. But one thing to consider is that if you look at the power spectrum from an image that's perfectly aligned image, has no astigmatism, if you look at the power spectrum, the tone rings, you'll see something that looks like astigmatism that's actually due to the anisotropic magnification. It takes the tone rings and it makes them ellipses. And so the approach that we've used in my lab is we measure the CTF from the uncorrected images, we take our individual particles, we correct them for the anisotropic magnification, and then we fix the CTF parameters to account for the known anisotropic magnification. This provides a really convenient way for checking if you have the problem, rather than looking at thallus chloride crystals. If you simply plot your data set, the defocus 1 versus defocus 2, and assuming you've got a spread of defocuses, and you don't have a constant astigmatism, you'll find that your defocus 1 versus defocus 2 falls off this y equals x line. Constant astigmatism would lead to a shift. Defocus 1 is always equal to defocus 2 plus or minus a constant. Whereas anisotropic magnification gives you defocus 1 is equal to defocus 2 times some constant. And over and above the line is exactly equivalent. It's just reversing which is defocus 1 and which is defocus 2. So this is a good diagnostic to see whether you have a problem. It doesn't tell you exactly how to fix it yet, but it tells you that you should do more investigation. But once you have fixed the problem, your defocus 1, defocus 2 collapse to that line. Nico.
I just wanted to say, for the correction of the frames, if you record the frames in super resolution, that interpolation error is a little bit reduced. You know,
right.
And then afterwards you do the Fourier cropping and so
right,
on.
Sure.
So that would be one reason why super resolution recording would make sense.
Yes. So what we do is, for the frames, we do a more sophisticated interpolation. So you can always reduce interpolation problems by doing a more expensive interpolation step. It's easier on particles than whole frames. Yifan's got a...
Oh, sorry. John, I also want to know, how big is too big? What can you tolerate and just ignore?
It will depend on the size of the particle. And you could probably, I can't think through this on my feet, but if you have a 100 angstrom particle and a 1% error, then a particle that's rotated might be 101 angstroms. And so that's a 1, divide that by 2 because it's a centered particle. So you've got a 0.5 angstrom problem at the edge of the particle. And that's going to limit your resolution to something like 1 angstrom. So you can do that sort of arithmetic, I think, to figure out how big a problem it is. Small particles probably won't have a problem. Nuclear pore complex, well, they're floppy. But something really big will have a bigger problem at a smaller.
Empirically, we have, I think, found that we're just under 1% or something.
Probably
it
not.
It always makes it worse to try and do the anisotropy.
Is that right? Okay. It's not surprising. For most small particles or even reasonable-sized particles, 1% is not much.
Following Nico's comments about this interpretation, as people tried, because by the end of the day, if we do this one, that like the imaging process rule 101, that is always say they don't do multiple interpretation. And then so they did this one first, and by the end of the day, you do reconstruction also, you need to do that. I remember when first Nico was explained to us that about the Fourier line, it was doing all in the once, in the last. I wonder if people try to combine this source into the last step.
That would be the ideal, right?
Instead of doing this thing here, but doing all the interpretation, you kind of measure, you know how much you need to do, but only doing it once in the last step when you do the reconstruction.
I think that's a really good idea. Having it in the program is also slightly terrifying, because if you mess that up, so if you mess that up, it's kind of nicer to fix your data, know you're working with good data, and then. But having it in the end, the 2D crystal software does it in the final interpolation step. That's the ideal. But FEI should fix the problem.
So here's the question. So I feel it's very dangerous to do at this step because
at which step?
Your assumption is the no stigmatism, right? But quite often it's a correlated.
No, there's no assumption there's no stigmatism. So at which step are you saying it's dangerous?
You are based on the defocus.
Right, and I'm saying this is not going to tell you how to fix the problem. It tells you should do more investigation. This doesn't even tell you the direction of astigmatism or anisotropic magnification. So right, this is a check to let you know there might be a problem, but warrants more investigation. This is not enough information to fix anisotropic magnification. Which direction is it in? I have no idea from this. But this is from Yifan's information published on TRIP V1, you can see the Polara. It's kind of when you deposit information on the web, you have no idea what you're exposing of yourself to the world. But this was something that Jinhua Zhao in my lab noticed when we started looking into this problem. Okay, so I just want to wrap up by going back to the questions I started with. How do you decide your pixel size and magnification? Well, you've got to make sure that the resolutions you're interested in are within your DQE, sorry, within your Nyquist limit, and are passed by the camera with a good DQE. How do you decide your exposure rate in terms of electrons per pixel per second? You've got to understand coincidence loss, and you need to make sure that you've got an acceptable level of coincidence loss to preserve the DQE of your camera for the relevant resolutions. How do you decide frame rate? The frame rate has to be fast enough so that you can do adequate exposure weighting. Incidentally, I hate the word dose because I work in a department with radiation physicists. And to them, dose means amount of absorbed energy, which we do not know for electron microscopy, so I always refer to it as exposure. We need to make sure that you have divided your movie up into enough frames that you can adequately do this exposure weighting procedure, and also that you don't have too much movement that occurs within each frame. And then the overall length of the movie, oops, I don't know why that says join. The overall length of the movie, you need to make sure that your total exposure on the specimen is enough to give you enough signal at low resolution to do 2D classification, 3D classification, and alignment. So I haven't shown much data from my own lab, but I did show, so this is my group at the moment, except Mohammed has left and Yazan has joined. But I showed some data from Samir, who's done some of the magnification calibration stuff, Jinhua, and Hui, who did the ATPAs, and then some older work from Lindsay Baker. And then we have rely on collaborators who help us out with lots of things. Okay, so I think we've had a nice discussion, but I think we have time for one or two questions.
Hey, John, I'm always curious with motion core and optical flow and those methods where the whole image can be distorted in non, you know, obvious ways. Whether anyone's looked at whether that can have a significant effect, say, on recovery by, you know, CTF correction, or if there can be sort of real space distortions that might affect
it, should make
resolution.
It better. Yeah. I would expect it would make it better. I don't know if anyone's done a comparison.
Make it
whether
better?
I would think so, because you're more coherently averaging your information.
I mean, you know, the ice deforms during the exposure. In the later frame, if you're trying to correct the CTF and you first distorted the image.
So not measuring the CTF.
Right. Well, yeah. Just in general, you're distorting the features in your image without a physical, you know, I don't know. It seems like there's something here which doesn't quite
I mean, and also if
work.
if you have a particle, you're also distorting your particle. But clearly the algorithm works extraordinarily well to high resolution in many cases. So I don't know the answer. Maybe a response from Yifan.
It seems that high frequency is fine, at least in the real space. One thing is that we have recently some images of particles sitting on graphene oxide, and you can see in the Fourier transform of the graphene spots. And then after motion core correction, that you can see that the spots getting sharper and stronger. And then and it seems like it's an indication that the real space that it became more, at least the graphene substrate became more coherent.
John, can you go back one slide real fast?
Sure.
For the very top part here, to fix your pixel size, considering the resolution of interest between your Nyquist limit and having the DQE, are you advocating that we always collect sort of with a small-ish pixel size? Because if you're collecting with a large pixel size, we're not filtering that information that's coming in from the microscope. And so that's definitely going to contribute to some folding and some sort of artifact. So I'm thinking about large molecules like the nuclear pore complex, where the pixel size is rather large. And so there must be some sort of artifacts. And what's your
I think the artifact is the DQE is worsened. And you can always improve the DQE on a detector like the K2 that has a sort of linear fall off by going to higher magnification. It comes at the price of smaller field of view, fewer particles. So it's a trade-off.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have to make that trade-off.
I mean, it varies in every case. I don't tell anybody anything.
Yeah. I'm curious what are the current thoughts on high-dose imaging. So really using 60 or 80 or 100 electrons per square angstrom, especially for small particles. Does this really help?
I think if the exposure weighting is done well, it shouldn't hurt. Whether there's been a demonstrated big improvement, I don't know, because it also comes at the price of bigger data, more longer movies. Nico, I know you've played with this. Have you seen any cases where a high dose image has led to a dramatic improvement? High exposure image? Also, a high exposure image is a high dose image, so that's a correct usage.
So we haven't done systematic experiments to go to very high exposures. I mean, it definitely helps to go to higher exposures than what we used to do.
Right.
But one problem potentially is that at the later stages of your movie, you get more distortions, maybe
right.
You know, distortions that are hard to follow. And then these low resolution terms have to be or can throw off the low resolution terms of the earlier frames so
right.
that you get an overall worse alignment. So I think there might be some problems.
Yes. I mean, the amazing thing is that everything seems to work now. So, yeah.
So what's the current thought on which frames to throw out?
So we don't throw out frames, and we haven't seen a benefit in throwing out frames. I know that polishing will, in a data-driven way, downweight the early frames. But I'm not sure that someone's done a very careful comparison of if that actually leads to significantly improved resolution. Yeah, we don't throw out anything.
So I just wanted to follow up on Dimitri's question. So I think maybe with a counting detector, maybe you know, it's not quite as a big of a difference by going to bigger, you know, longer and longer doses or exposures. But for an integrating detector, it definitely makes a big difference because you don't have the higher DQE at lower frequencies, Right, so you recover some of that by having a longer, a bigger dose.
So you make up for the lack of DQE at low resolution by using, you can always make up for low efficiency by doing the experiment more times by sending in more electrons.
I have a question about the data you collect on F20 and the Creos.
Yes.
So you get 4.5 on F20 and 4.6 on Creos.
4.4, 4.5, but yes.
And did you compare the two maps at similar resolution?
Yeah, they're basically identical.
So I assume they are from different pixel size, right?
Not that different. It's 1.06 angstroms per pixel on the, actually, no, they are. So 1.06 angstroms per pixel on the Creos and 1.45 angstroms per pixel on the F20.
So you don't see any difference even at 4.5, and they are from different pixel size?
I don't think there's much of a noticeable difference.
Sorry, you're talking about the 4.6 from the Creos? Mm-hmm. But there was an artifact of badly motion-corrected images.
Yeah, it was a
I
lower...
I just want to defend our little Creos.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. No, once we did the... and I should say, so this data was collected with GDN, which is a detergent, a lot like digitonin, that produces very strong gradients in the ice thickness, and maybe produces a lot of anisotropic motion. I noticed that one of the groups that uses aligned parts quite consistently is Ju Chen, who's somewhere, I can't see her. And maybe it's this sort of weirdness in the ice that leads to a lot of motion that aligned parts handles particularly well. And that's why we need it in that case.